where people are trying to think for the animal instead of letting the animal speak.
Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, answer zoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals. Today, we're talking with Dr. Mariska Krett. She's the principal investigator in the Cognitive Psychology Unit at Leiden University. Dr. Krett studies the expression of emotions and their impact on social decision-making across species. She'll be telling us how she measures emotions and interprets them objectively, and the many interesting applications of this research, from animal welfare to understanding human emotions. Now, it took a while for Dr. Krett and I to be able to find a time to record. There was a lot of back and forth and schedule changes and people getting sick. And you can even hear a little bit of a cough from the background as we just decided to go for it, because who knew when we were all going to be healthy again. But I think you're going to find this to be a really interesting conversation and a great way to start our series about how animals perceive the world, the animal protagonist. So thank you for joining me today as we ask the question, what's the deal with animals?
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, I think is off. They're awesome.
What is the deal with animals? Oh gosh.
So the deal with the animals, you know? What the deal with animals is that
it's really the deal with animals for us.
So what do you think is the deal with animals? Would you please introduce yourself and share your pronouns?
Sure. My name is Mariska Krett, and I work as a professor at Leiden University at the Department of Cognitive Psychology. I study emotions and the expressions of emotions in humans, but also in our closely living relatives. So that's the great apes, mostly chimpanzees, bonobos, but also orangutans, gorillas, and some other primate species as well.
Yeah, so fascinating. I find that this particular subject is really, really interesting because for the longest time, you know, people didn't think animals had emotions. Or
still many people who think they don't have emotions, actually.
Yeah, I guess that is true. It's a little more accepted now, I suppose. Hopefully a lot more accepted. But that even if they did have emotions, you couldn't, there was no point in studying them because you couldn't ask an animal what their emotions were. And so there was no objective way to study that. But a lot of people have figured out ways of doing that. And you are one of them. How do you objectively study emotions in other animals?
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to realize that there is a difference between emotions and feelings. So when people talk about emotions, they are sometimes mixing it with feelings, the things that are really going on in our head. But we can have emotions and not be completely aware of them. So what I'm studying are the things that we can observe. So expressions of emotion in the face, in the body, in the voice. But I don't know if animals or if all animals are completely aware of them. Probably not. At the same time, I also don't think that humans are the only species that are aware of their own emotions, right? So the approach that I am taking is an experimental, non-invasive approach. I'm trained as an experimental psychologist, where we look at things like attention, memory, cognitive bias. So, for example, emotions, well, and the expressions of the emotions of the people around us or the conspecifics around us are super important. So it's very natural that our attention is driven towards them, that we remember those emotional situations better than situations that are not really relevant. So by studying these underlying mechanisms, I'm trying to get insight into emotions and compare different species, because I'm interested in, well, what makes each species unique. Not just what makes humans unique, but what makes each species unique. Because every species has its own unique features. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a separate species, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to, reveal all those unique aspects.
Why does it matter whether someone knows they're having an emotion or not? If they're aware of their emotions?
Well, indeed, like you said, I often get the comment, well, you can't really study emotions in animals because animals can't talk about their emotions. Of course, that's true. But, when humans talk about their emotions or their feelings, do they really know what they're talking about? Do they really have insight into their emotions? And also, do they want to share it? Are they honest in talking about them? I think that we have to accept in some way that we can never completely understand what another person is feeling, because we are not that other person. And then it doesn't matter if that other person is a chimpanzee or a human being. We can never completely feel what another person is feeling. So I think that criticism that we can't ask animals about their feelings also applies to humans, and actually maybe even more so, because with humans we often think that we know what another person is feeling, because that other person looks like us, and it's much easier to fill it in. But I think it's also much easier than to make incorrect assumptions, and therefore actually I think it's also important when studying these things in people to use more implicit methods and not ask about emotions, but to look at underlying mechanisms as well.
The methods that you use to research primate emotions, do you then use those exact same methods to research human emotions?
Yes.
And compare those?
Yeah, exactly.
What's an example of that?
So, for example, attention is really, really helpful to study. So the things that species, individuals that attend to are the things that are relevant, evolutionarily relevant. So what you see in psychological attention paradigms is that people's attention immediately shift to pictures of threats, for example, when you present them on a computer screen, or pictures of guns, for example, or pictures of emotional expressions of other people. Those are the things that are really relevant to pay attention to, and that's that's true for every species, right? It has benefits to immediately attend to the things that are threatening to you or that are that can give you something, like attractive potential partners, for example. Those things capture attention. And by studying attention and manipulating the different stimuli that you present in your experiments, you can find out what is relevant for a particular species and what is relevant for a particular individual.
And so are you looking at things like arousal level as well? So how fast the heart beats?
Yes.
breathing. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that's really important because attention is just one thing. I think it's important to look at many different implicit indicators of emotion. And arousal is also a very important one that I look at a lot. Although measuring arousal in great apes is always tricky because while we can, and I also only want to use non-invasive methods, and that means that you cannot put electrodes on the body because they would immediately take it off.
Of course.
Yeah. So you have to use other types of techniques. For example, one technique is a thermal camera. You can film them with this heat camera and get measures, but it's still not completely trustworthy method, I would say. So now we're actually, we came up with something quite original. We're doing eye tracking experiments as well. So that's to study where they're exactly looking at on a computer screen. So facial expressions, bodily expressions, making eye contact, those things. And when we are doing that, they are drinking. They're drinking juice so that their head is relatively stable and we can make accurate measurements. But now we're modifying the drinking nipple so that it can also give us a measure of blood flow.
And oh, nice.
That we can maybe, hopefully, well, that's the idea, compute heart rate. And maybe from the saliva, we can also get measures like cortisol, for example. So hormone, stress hormone levels. So that's how we're trying to get measures of arousal. But yeah, there's not a lot of research on it in great apes.
No.
So, for example, if you look at macaque research, that is done a lot because research on macaque is allowed, also invasive research. So yeah, researchers can just put a monkey in a monkey chair and hook it up with all kinds of equipment and then measure all those things. That's not really the approach I like to take.
No, it seems like you would be measuring their stress responses.
Exactly, when you want to study
lab
emotions.
Experiment, yeah.
Exactly. So I am never, ever separating animals from the social group. So that's also quite difficult because you want one individual behind the screen and not all of them at the same time. Yeah. So, but once you've made that clear, by just positively rewarding the animals, they actually understand, and they also find it frustrating if you want something from them and they don't know what you want. But once they know, they actually are very cooperative. Yeah.
That's true.
And I think to see things in the computer screen. Yeah, that's true for kids as well and for people as well, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And our dogs, even any of the animals that interact with us a lot, I think that we try to communicate with, it's all a matter of how well that communication is working.
Actually, I participated when I was a postdoc in Japan at the Primate Research Institute of Kyoto University. I participated in an experiment and I was not given any instructions because, well, you can't verbally instruct apes either, and they wanted to make a comparison. And I was playing an economic game with another human and it was so frustrating because I didn't know the rules of the game. I couldn't ask anything and it was so vague. And after the experiment, I actually felt completely frustrated. So
yeah, I think it's funny how people feel like they're communicating really well with their children or their dogs or even other humans. And it's just not coming across at all.
No, indeed. So that's also something to really be aware of when you design experiments, that it's simple, that it's clear, and that it's fun. Well, if it's not fun, in my case, they just don't sit behind the screen. So that's easy.
Right. So you know if they're wanting to participate or not because they're...
Yeah, that's very obvious. Yeah.
Yes, there or not.
Yeah.
I mean, you said you were trying to learn about the uniqueness of different species. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you also take what you learn when you're working with the apes and you translate that into working with humans as well.
Yes. So, for example, one application I could see is in clinical practice. for example, with people, well, actually with everyone, but especially people who are not that verbal. So I'm thinking about very young children or different clinical populations. I don't know, maybe, oh, we have quite a refugee problem at the moment in the Netherlands. There's so many people coming in and not getting proper treatment. There's language barriers there. Maybe those implicit measures could be really, really useful for diagnosing problems and, yeah, maybe giving handles for treatment. I really see a link there. But, yeah, my research focuses mainly on the bigger fundamental questions, so really mm-hmm. trying to get to know more about emotions in different species. And I'm sure that can be really relevant to apply, but that's the next step.
Who do you think would be using this in their everyday research? Would doctors be using it then, as you said, with other humans? But is there an application as well for zoos or for...
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, so, well, both. I am actually collaborating with a psychiatrist who's interested in using... or not only interested, we actually just started using some of these tasks in patients with autism and schizophrenia. Mm. And that's looking really promising. And also, yes, in zoos, I think it could also have applications. So, for instance, I'm also involved in a project where we want to give animals more control over their lives. Captive animals.
Mm-hmm.
So the apes in the zoo, for example. And one of the things that they have no control of over whatsoever, but which is really important in life, is the choice of their partner. And in orangutans, this is quite a problem because female orangutans are transferred to another zoo at some point, because they need to find a partner. They can't stay in their own group. That's also what happens in the wild. At some point, the females leave their group and shop around. Well, in the zoo world, they can't just shop around. So what the zoo staff is doing, they look at the genetic map, and based on that, they select a male orangutan in Frankfurt. And then the female is transferred there because that male hasn't produced much offspring yet. But there's no match. It doesn't work. The female doesn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
So we are now using those implicit measures to get more insight into individual preferences, partner preferences.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, is this female, well, what kind of personality does she like? What does she find attractive? We're also planning to set up different Skype dates and observe the behavior. Yeah. So everything that can give us more insight into preferences that can help to improve those transfers.
Yeah, that's huge for the implications for animal welfare in so many areas, not just zoos, because it has traditionally been that if you wanted to breed two animals, you put them together, and if they didn't breed, you basically forced that. That's what happens to a lot of the females. They are held down, they are artificially inseminated, all sorts of pretty what we would consider horrendous if this was a human being. Situations, exactly. and that's true for so many animals, not just for animals in zoos.
No.
Is this, if this works well, is that going to seriously change what zoos are, and how zoos are doing things now?
Yes, yeah, but it will take time. So this project actually in the Netherlands already became quite popular in the media, so under the name of Tinder for orangutans, and it was all over the media. I think it definitely has huge potential, but it is very difficult. It is very difficult to really design tasks that can give very accurate predictive predictive outcomes of this transfer success. So it will take a couple of years before we can really say, okay, the orangutans that are using this method are happier than the orangutans that were, you know, that were just randomly moved to a different location.
Matched so up. Not, yeah.
Yeah. Before claiming this this method Tinder for orangutans, I want to be really sure that it works. Mm. And for that, much more research is needed. So that will take more years. But I definitely believe in it, and I'm continuing with this.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I know that at least anecdotally, when breeders are breeding dogs, they find that if there is a strong emotional connection between the parent canines, that they have a lot more babies in that litter. So if it's a match maybe that is more forced, then they might not have a very big litter. But if it tends to be that if they have a relationship with the other dog and it's a friend dog, you know, that the litter could be significantly larger than an average litter size. I wonder if you'd end up, I mean, orangutans generally only have one baby anyway, right? But what are you going to be looking at to know whether this was successful?
Yeah, so that takes years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so the number of offspring you would want to know. So this is really a longitudinal project, and we're just at the beginning. But, well, and also we can't look at all the indicators of partner preferences that an orangutan would use in the wild.
Mm.
So because, well, they're in a physically different location, right? So maybe we can do something with smell. Well, in COVID time, it wasn't possible, but maybe it's possible to do something with smell samples, but it's quite difficult. So what we've been doing now is mostly focusing on the physical appearance, so the face and the voice as well. But in a real life situation, orangutans may use a different strategy. I mean, they have such huge differences in personality. So one female can be very different than another one, but usually the females are the ones that are really picky, and the males don't really care because you know, the females, they have to make a good choice because they are with this offspring for, I don't know, 8 years or so. It takes a lot of their energy and time. It's a huge investment.
Only have one baby per
Or
it's twins really common?
No, usually they have one. And it stays with them for years. So they also breastfeed for a really long time. Yeah. So it's not that, well, in humans, 2 years after the first, you have to say, I'm pregnant of the second now. My son is two. That's not typical for a orangutan mother.
Hmm. They breastfeed for 5 or 6 years?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad I didn't breastfeed quite that long.
Yeah, me too. Oh my God.
Like two and a half years. That was plenty for me.
Still long. Yeah.
It is still long. Yeah. At the moment when people have to go right back to work again, it is still a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm fascinated to the orangutan Tinder fascinates me because it really is this idea that emotions should matter in animals. And particularly maybe even more so in our closest relatives, because we know that they experience emotions. I think it's more obvious in primates than almost any other animal. It would be very hard for anybody to have an interaction with an ape and go, oh, that ape isn't having any emotions. I can't even imagine somebody thinking that.
Actually,
really.
All the criticism also comes from people who don't really directly work with great apes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's still researchers who are claiming that animals don't have emotions because you need language for that.
Yeah.
For example.
It's also, I think, beneficial for people in some areas to say that animals don't have emotions, because if they did, that would be huge.
Yeah, they have to change their lifestyle. Yeah. Yeah,
research or just in everyday, you know, lifestyles too.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really easy indeed. But I think this idea of giving animals more control, I think it could be it could be a very broad thing. So not just on partner choice, but maybe we can also give them more control over, things in their enclosure. I'm thinking about captive animals right now.
Mm-hmm.
Or food or whatever. If we can, via those implicit measures, get more insight into any kind of preference, and we can use that knowledge to make them feel better.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like that preference tests are becoming really popular as well in a lot of different areas, even in farming, for instance. Yeah. You know, if you're farming an animal and they aren't healthy, then, or they're not happy, then they're often not healthy either. So the more that, you know, you can increase animal welfare, even when the fate of that animal is ultimately not ideal for them, how they're living still is a very important aspect of that.
Yeah, those two are super connected, as is mm-hmm. the case in humans, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Well, what is the downside to what you do then? What do you find most frustrating? For me, I would think it would be trying to have those conversations with people that are not understanding the research or who don't think that it's...
Yeah, but those people don't really... Actually, I don't really mind. They actually trigger me to work harder to prove the opposite.
Yes.
So they don't really bother me. But just on a very practical level, what I have to deal with a lot is, for example, the keepers in the zoo, who mm-hmm. are usually, well, they really, really love their animals, but they don't have a scientific background. So they're, I really have to also take their perspective and explain why research is important, and also the type of research that doesn't have a direct application, mm-hmm. because that's the research that they usually see most value in, whereas right. I also really think that the big questions, like, do animals have emotions, or what do they feel, or what do they recognize the emotions of conspecifics? Those questions, I think, are also really important. Really important to ask. But so that's one practical thing that I sometimes struggle with, but not always. It depends on the keepers. The keepers are really, really important for my research.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Well, what about social anxiety with apes? Do they experience? Is it hard for some of them to talk with other apes? Not talk, you know what I mean? Interact with? Mm-hmm. Are they shy? Do they have issues with that?
Yeah, definitely. There's as many individual differences between, well, in a chimpanzee group as in a group of people. So you have all those things. You have social anxiety. You have depression. You have apes with autistic traits. Yeah, you have all of it. And I'm not saying that it's the same.
Mm-hmm.
Probably there are, some things are exactly the same, but there's probably also differences. And as I said, every species is unique. So we shouldn't always start from the human perspective and ask the question, mm-hmm. do they have social anxiety? Do they have autism? Do they have this, this, and this, and this? But mm-hmm. also start from the animal perspective and mm-hmm. see and observe their behavior and observe their emotional problems. Because, you know, maybe there's differences there. Maybe they have things that we don't have.
Mm.
And if we don't start with the animal, but we start with human, we're always going to miss things.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example... Also with emotions, we already see differences between human cultures.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there are some words that exist in English that don't exist in Dutch, or the other way around. There's cultural rules about, you know, which emotions you express or even which emotions you should feel. Mm-hmm. I think I've read somewhere that in the US that there's a big focus on always feeling very positive and happy. That is what you want to be. Whereas mm-hmm. in Japan, for example, it's more about being in balance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite different, right? And if you mm-hmm. already see that, that difference between different human culture, then I can imagine that, well, there's, of course, huge differences between species, especially species with a very different body. Maybe birds have a specific emotion when they fly that we can never, ever experience. I can imagine that could be the case because, well, it is beneficial for birds to fly. So probably there's an emotion coupled to it that motivates them to do it. I'm just thinking out loud now, but,
yeah,
you know, maybe there's emotions there, out there, that we don't have.
And it's worth asking that question just to find out.
I think so, yeah. And of course, it's really difficult to not take a human perspective because I am a human.
Yes.
So, but at least let's try to take the animal perspective.
Yeah, the implicit bias of just being a human and seeing things from our perspective must be very difficult.
Maybe that is my. So your question, what is your biggest struggle or biggest challenge? What did you, I don't remember what exactly, how you phrased it, but maybe that is my frustration that I'm always going to be a human.
Yeah, I have that same frustration often since I was a kid, in fact. What is the most fun? I imagine just working with the apes themselves is just absolutely fascinating. I mean, I could watch other animals all day.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. So what I find really funny is that, well, as a researcher, you come up, well, you have a research question, and then you come up with ideas on how to test whether whether your hypothesis is correct or not. So you're designing experiments. And then you've done that, and you're doing it, and then the ape comes up with a completely different solution that you didn't anticipate beforehand. So, for example, I had one male bonobo. So let me think, what was it? Yeah, it had to tap on a certain position on the screen, and then it was a correct answer on the trial. But instead of tapping, he would just swipe across the screen and then get 50% correct. And he was fine with that. And he just accepted, you know, that he had, on half of the trials, he got a small piece of apple, and on the other half, he didn't. So it was really difficult to teach him the task because he was already happy with the results.
Yeah.
So that's just one example. Where they come up with a different solution and you really have to rethink how you set up your experiment and how you're going to test your research mm-hmm. question.
Yeah. That motivator is very important, isn't it? He sounds like he was, happy with the results.
Yeah,
so
it was good enough. Yeah. Why would you?
Why try harder?
Why try harder? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Or they always come up with things that you can't anticipate. And the orangutans, they're really, really interested in the technology itself. So in the computer and in all the, well, we designed 3 orangutan proof setups. And so this third one now seems sturdy enough. But the other ones, they just, took it apart. It was, and they had a lot of fun doing that because they
are
so
strong.
Cute. Yeah, it was not that they were aggressive or something. They really just wanted to study it.
Interested in how you feel about having animals captive being used for research, even if it's fairly benign.
Yeah, so Well, they're in my case, they're not being used for research. I just switch on the computer screen, and if they want to sit behind it, they can sit behind it and they can see things. If they want to leave, they leave. So that's it's not even considered research. So I'm fine with that, and I also see that the animals like it, and we are actually also studying that. So we're studying the effects of these experiments. Mm-hmm. On their daily behavior, and we find evidence that it is enriching for them. Otherwise, I also wouldn't do it. But in general, keeping apes in zoos, I'm quite ambivalent, to be honest. Mm. On the one hand, I think those beautiful creatures should not be kept in captivity. But on the other hand, I think it's zoos play a really, really important role, or different roles actually. So one of them is that that people get in touch with nature and see animals and learn about animals and learn about intelligent animals as well, not just for our entertainment. I think the role of zoos has changed a lot. It's not about entertainment, or it shouldn't be about entertainment anymore, but also about education and research. And another reason is that they are really good ambassadors for their conspecifics living in the wild. Mm-hmm. So if people see the animals in the zoo, they can also learn about conservation in the wild. Well, that's not the case for great apes. It's not possible to reintroduce them in the wild. But for other species, the zoo plays a really important role in reintroducing individuals into the wild. But
then why isn't it possible to reintroduce apes?
No, you can't introduce an ape that's born in a zoo into the wild. It won't survive.
They just don't know how to take care of themselves, or another a troop won't take them in?
No, indeed. Mm. No, so that's not possible. But for other species, that is possible.
Interesting. I wonder why it wouldn't work for them.
Well, their life is in the zoo is so different than in the wild. You know, you have all those predators and all those poisonous. Poisonous food items, you have competing groups, and all of that you don't have in the zoo. How are you going to train an individual for all that? How are you going to prepare? Mm-hmm. It's really difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that in Indonesia you have sanctuaries for orangutans, so where orangutan babies whose mother was killed for the bushmeat trade, they get jungle training, really, really intense jungle training, and sometimes are reintroduced. But the problem now is that there's no jungle left to place them in.
Yeah.
There's not enough space in the wild jungle, so they just stick around in those sanctuaries because there's no space.
I think orangutans are probably one of those animals that are not going to be around that much longer, certainly not in the wild.
Well, that's the case for all great ape species, and indeed, especially orangutans, but also bonobos. And bonobos, they only live in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mm. And do we really? So, if we get rid of all the bonobos in the zoos, that's about 200 worldwide that we're talking about. So it's not a lot. There's only 200 bonobos living in captivity in the whole world. But If we
stopped breeding them and...
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. If we stopped breeding them, then we would give the full responsibility to the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is a complete mess, for the continuation of the survival of this species that is our closest living relative.
I, too, have been ambivalent for a long time about zoos. I actually started my career working and thinking I wanted to be a zookeeper and work in zoos because that's how I saw I could be close to, the big cats primarily, but, any animals But, you know, once I got into zoos and I kind of realized, oh, this isn't exactly what I was expecting. You know, it was a lot of bureaucracy and it was a lot of, you know, which are the most charismatic animals that are going to bring the most guests into the zoo. So those are the ones that get the nicer habitats and have more investment in zookeeper time and all of that. Yeah. And it was very eye-opening and not in a good way. And I decided that wasn't really where I wanted to be. And I still,
but it's not the fault of the zoos.
No, not often not.
They don't get enough money. Mm-hmm. So they have to think that way commercially as well.
The zoo near here is an amazing zoo for a zoo, but it's also government funded primarily, or a lot of it. And the zookeepers are technically government employees, or at least they were when I was there. And so they weren't allowed overtime. And so animals, you know, they would have to leave at a certain time. And occasionally an animal was not, you know, looked after as well as it should have been because there was not that time investment that needed to be there. And again, a lot of the keepers would have definitely stayed later if they had been allowed to and worked even more, you know, probably to their own personal detriment, happily. But it just wasn't allowed. And that was a really hard one for me because we lost a few animals in the area that I was working in, to things that shouldn't have happened. And it was so frustrating to me. And that was a really good zoo too. So I can imagine, you know, sometimes what goes on in some of the zoos that maybe aren't, you know, don't have as much funding. But at the same time, I love seeing the animals. I do think that there's some benefit to going to a zoo and seeing, you know,
with your children, right? And explain things.
Yeah. Having those, you know, visual interactions, I do think that probably there's going to be other ways in the future that we can do that. That we won't need zoos for that particular thing, and maybe zoos will become more of a sanctuary sort of experience for animals that need it, and they don't have to be exhibited as well. But it's absolutely fascinating to be able to sit there and just watch the gorillas for as long as you want, you know.
Yeah, but also, like, you know, so you said, well, what if we, for example, stop the breeding program? That also has huge consequences for the animals themselves, because getting a child for a bonobo, for example, is also, you know, really, really important. Really important for their well-being.
Yeah.
And if the group just dies out, that's also,
Their particular welfare would not be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. The bonobos. So
there's many, many considerations. It's not so easy. It's easy to say, just let's stop zoos. But, you know, what are you going to do with the animals?
Yeah, there's a lot that.
Yeah, the animals in the zoos, but also what's going to happen with all the animals living in the wild. Mm-hmm. Are they going to be protected? No.
Yeah, there was a zoo in Singapore. Have you been to Singapore before?
Yeah, years ago, but not to the zoo.
The zoo is a really it's kind of amazing because it's almost like they've taken the fence and they've just like stuck it around some jungle, and then whatever was in the jungle is now in the zoo. And you know, it's not exactly like that, but it feels that way because the orangutans, for instance, they are allowed pretty much all of the canopy in the zoo. And so they can go up into the canopy for a very large portion of the zoo. And then there's an area they can come down and an island and that sort of thing. But they just hang out in the trees most of the time. They're hardly ever on the island except to go down and drink some water and then kind of come back up again. And then there's certain times a day where they can come down and hang out with humans. And people can get their pictures taken with them, and they just kind of stand there behind you and maybe line up as a group of five, and the tourist stands in front of them and gets their picture with like five orangutans just hanging out.
Wait, without any separation?
Nope, no separation. They had this one program for a long time was called breakfast with orangutans, and they would bring the mom down with her baby, and she would hang out in a little like forested corner of the cafeteria and hang out and eat her basket of fruit with her baby. And then you would get your pictures with them together, and everybody would eat their breakfast in the cafeteria while she hung out there with her baby. And then she would leave at the end of breakfast. And it was this very interactive experience in Singapore, particularly with the orangutans. And again, it was really hard to figure out how to feel about that. Like being able to have such a close interaction as just a regular person who doesn't work with primates for anybody would be such a draw. But is that really the right way to be interacting with
a wild animal, you know, it's also a captive animal, right? Mm-hmm. I think we have to accept that the zoo is not the jungle. And this is also something I had to really talk about with zoo staff, because in the beginning, a lot of zoos were under the impression that everything should be so as naturalistic as possible and as similar to the jungle they came from as possible. Mm-hmm. But I think it's much more important to look at what is good for them, what is enriching for them. And if that's a computer screen, why not? You know? Mm-hmm. If there can be more interaction between the animal and animals and the visitors, I think it's good as long as the animals can get the choice.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that many animals would want to do that. So for example, I can see that many bonobos, especially the young ones, they really want to interact with the visitors. They bang on the glass and they play chasing game with the human kids, and but again individual differences.
An interaction would be enriching. It seems like it would be. Yeah. And so much harm has also been caused by that idea that, again, as you said, everything has to be totally natural. There was an orangutan many years ago in the U.S. that was taught sign language and had most of his childhood with his instructor, lived with her, and he was taken away and then spent, you know, the last years of his life, essentially decades alone in a zoo with very natural, I'm using quotes here, natural environment around him, but no interaction with humans because it had been decided that wasn't good for him.
The documentary is called The Ape Who Went to College. It's the story of an orangutan named Chantek, who is raised as a human child on the American University campus during the 70s and 80s. The documentary was from PBS in 2014. It's an excellent documentary, and one that really makes you question the idea of a natural environment being best for all captive wildlife. But if you're going to watch it, definitely have a box of tissues nearby.
Yeah.
And he was just lonely and depressed, and it was the saddest.
I think there's a similar story. I think there was a similar documentary with a chimp. But yeah, indeed, you can look it up.
Yeah.
But there's many sad stories like that, where people are trying to think for the animal instead of letting the animal speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if there was a book that you could share with all of the listeners, what would that book be?
Well, one book that really inspired me is the book by Charles Darwin on the expression of emotion in man and animal, mm-hmm. 1872, because there's a lot in it that is still very, very relevant and still very inspiring. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really good good starting point.
A very early starting point,
yeah. And then I also think a book by Kristen Andrews, mm-hmm. How to Observe Animals, How to Look at Animals.
The book is a Cambridge Elements, The Philosophy of Biology series, How to Study Animal Minds by Kristen Andrews.
And of course, the book recommendation links are always in the show notes.
There she also describes how important it is to use the same terms when we are studying humans as when we are studying our close relatives, because if we are speaking about the smile in the case of humans, and we're talking about the pulling up of the corners of the lips in the terms of chimpanzees, that's not really a fair comparison then. So we have to use the same methods and the same terms. And I think that's a really, really nice book to read as well. It's not very thick.
It's something that we do all the time, right? The definition of words changes how we feel about what's going on. And for instance, I did some research on sheep and talking about friendship in sheep and whether sheep form friendships or not. And just having to explain why I was using the term friendship versus conspecifics who like to spend time together or who do spend time together doing similar things. Like, that is my definition of friendship. So why don't we just call it friendship?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Kristen Andrews, she wrote a book recently.
Yeah. I will link those.
And I also really always enjoy reading the books by Frans de Waal, a Dutch primatologist, he's at Emory University.
Yes.
And
he posts a lot of very cute animal photos on Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. But also interesting anecdotes that I think are really important and inspiring for empirical studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So would you share an early childhood formative memory about your connection with animals?
Yeah, there's so many. I don't have one with animal emotion or with animals, for example.
With either one, something that really inspired you or made you feel connected to other animals?
Yeah, so well, we always had budgies when I was really, really young, as a young child. My parents always had budgies, and I always really enjoyed interacting with them. I really, really loved them. And I remember one in particular, and he was always, always with me, and then he became ill. He had some kind of cancer, and it was one evening he was really not doing well at all. I think I must have been, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 or something like that. And he was just sitting in my hand, really, really sick. And at one point I had to go to bed. My mom told me, it's time, you have to go to bed and put the bird in the cage. And I didn't want to do it, but then in the end I did it. And the bird he was very weak with his last force, tried to fly back in my hand. And the next morning it was dead. And I never forget that. And I just regret so much just not, spending those last few hours with him in my hand. And I'm sure, that connection that humans feel with their pets is often real. I'm not saying that what humans think animals are feeling is always accurate, but that there's definitely this connection that we should take very seriously.
Yeah, it affects us whether it is
exactly,
quote, real or not real.
Yeah. True.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?
We are in the middle of the animal kingdom. We are not at the top of the animal kingdom. We try to think that we are, but we aren't. I mean, if other species would go extinct, we would go extinct as well. We're completely dependent on other animals for the whole ecosystem. Humans tend to think that they excel at everything, but that's not true. I mean, birds can fly, bats can use sonar, whales can communicate over great distances. There's so many fascinating things that animals can do that we cannot do. And in our arrogance, we often overlook that. And I think what's the deal with animals? We should definitely open up and try to learn from them and and use our huge cognitive capacities to protect them. I think that's that's the big deal. If I don't know if that's answering your question, but
it does. Yeah, I think that's excellent because it's true. It's the idea that we can live without animals, I think, is one that people subconsciously believe, is that if all the animals were to disappear, well, that's, you know, it would be sad, but we'd still be here, but we wouldn't.
No, we won't be here.
No,
but without the animals, there would not be plants, and we can't live without oxygen. And yeah, there would not be, wouldn't be possible. So yes, we need to find a way to live together.
That was Dr. Mariska Kret. She's a full professor at Leiden University in the Netherlands, Cognitive Psychology Unit, and leads the Comparative Psychology and Effective Neuroscience Lab. If you enjoyed this show and have any questions or comments about this episode or about the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com. Leave me a message. I will always read them, and this is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow and review wherever you listen to your podcasts, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. The Deal with Animals theme music was composed by Kai Stranskoff, and many of the episodes in the series were edited by Natasha Matzart. The Deal with Animals is part of the iRoar Animal Podcast Network. What do you think is the deal with animals?